Thanks very much for having me. And the primary reason for coming here is to get Professor Goldsmith to sign my book. Could I, if you know Jack, could you sign that? Oh, I'm sorry, you can see I read it. In fact, I even assign it. I do assign it to my students.
Great.
And I don't know what you've been doing lately, but that's a very nice 2006 explanation, Who Controls the Internet. And it's got a lot of very important stuff. And
looks like I signed it already, actually, back in 2006.
All right,
anyway.
Is that you?
Yeah,
God, you got to improve your penmanship, my friend. Anyway, yeah, it doesn't look like Jack Goldsmith. So anyway, thanks. By the way, the journal editors hold their hands up. Who's the managing editor? Who's the articles editor? I just want to see who you people are. You haven't published anything of mine for 10 years. And 10 years ago, you published 220 pages. And we would both agree that that was too much. We should spread it out a little bit, you know. So maybe we can come to some kind of new parcelization program. So the hot topic is net neutrality. Far be it for me to say that I'm tired of this and want to move on to different discussions. I don't know what Tim's view of that is, but for students looking at this and looking at the world and going out into the world as attorneys and as policymakers and perhaps as business entrepreneurs, it obviously has a lot of salience, and I don't blame you for being interested in it. So how do I start? Well, I think there are basically two views of this marketplace we're talking about. And the first view is an engineering architecture view that focuses on internet exceptionalism. There's one internet, as the FCC now says in its new net neutrality order, there's one internet, and it was designed by very crafty planners who constructed the net to be open. And that made it possible for innovation to be driven by these design characteristics. And has a lot of nice properties, allowing startups to access key parts of the internet, buying pieces, particularly transport pieces, without asking anybody permission. Barriers to entry are eliminated, and new products flourish. There's another view. I'll call it the marketplace view. Well, let me see. We're at Harvard. Let me go the full mile and call it the Schumpeterian view after your late colleague. He died in 1950, but to me that just seems like a late colleague, that's all. And you should be proud having Joseph Schumpeter among your numbers. Okay, so what we do have here is something quite extraordinary, but we've seen it many times before, and we see it today. It's a market. It features robust competition between rival suppliers, but simultaneously widespread cooperation between the makers of complements. Things fit together without any explicit system-wide coordination, a spontaneous order. The internet, by the way, is not one institution. It's a network of networks, and that's actually quite an important distinction. Many of those networks rely on closed access and proprietary content and all kinds of innovative structures. And these connections between these types of networks raise the value of all. In this complex ecosystem, virtually every one of its moving parts is owned by profit-maximizing enterprises or utility-maximizing consumers. The quest for profit drives innovation. That pursuit is open in the same way the computer market is open. Selling inputs to startups is not at all unusual. Entrants don't have to ask permission, not to be licensed. They buy needed inputs. They strike mutually advantageous deals with other entrants or with incumbents. And then sometimes, they hope they build a better mousetrap. Results are determined by consumer demand and the efficiency in production. So complicated structures of coordination emerge. Business models come and go. Some will be called open, others called closed. They compete for support among venture capitalists, option-thirsty code writers, and the public markets. Resources, intellectual and financial, flow to where efficiencies are found. Differential prices drive efficiencies almost everywhere one looks. Peering arrangements incent backbone providers to build out vast capacity. Pay-to-play traffic agreements do the same, agreements between ISPs and backbones. Content providers like Google pay ISPs like AOL to be featured as easy-to-use default applications. Caching and content delivery networks speed up the delivery of high-valued content via fees paid by edge innovators wishing to access the internet's fast lane. Importantly, the extraction of such payments expands and improves the network of networks, putting better content on customers' screens faster and giving the best innovators the ability to improve their products, breaking through the din. Sometimes, ISPs create such service or provide such services internally, and other times they contract to supply such services via partners. Sometimes they simply let customers find their own way using, as Ronald Coase called it, the price system. There is no fixed template for a firm's efficient scope. It is a constant matter for debate, exploration, experimentation, and adaptation. Call it creative destruction. AOL's walled garden of the mid-1990s, supplying ease of use and proprietary content to a curious world, was extremely productive, bringing tens of millions of new users online and helping to create the mass market internet. And then it was defunct. Vertical integration, pushing cable TV systems to offer cable modem services for high-speed computer network access, required the creation of At Home, a vertically integrated part of the cable network. Combined with Excite, a portal provider, large cable operators pushed millions of households into the broadband era, in the process investing tens of billions of dollars to upgrade networks. And then it turned out there was no there. The ISP market was nil. Customers simply demanded transport to the network, and the cable ISP product went bust. No open access regulation, just economic evolution. These vertical relations provoke no fear among empirically oriented economists. Generally speaking, vertical integration is a feature, not a bug. The theory of vertical foreclosure details issues that might arise. Research shows that they are highly unlikely. False positives seem to dominate the regulatory discussion, whether it be the near hysteria over Cable At Home's venture or the Time Warner AOL merger, where a cable operator was said to use its broadband ISP leverage to exclude Time Warner's content rivals, or the FCC's bizarre overshooting in the Comcast network management case. So among the two views, perhaps I gave away my take. In my humble opinion, this marketplace view is the more realistic approach, the one that sees how the market develops to encourage innovation and serve consumers. There are a lot of interesting economics here, and it's chock full of creative destruction. Let's just note a couple of examples. Take the case of Docomo, the wireless arm of NTT in Japan. In 1999, this leading wireless or mobile provider created a walled garden for wireless internet content. It became a huge hit, both with customers and with content providers. In just 2 years, wireless became the leading form of internet access in Japan. Its rivals had to immediately duplicate its success. Three mobile nets now compete with rival walled gardens. Just recently, I was talking to an executive of one of these three competitors, and I asked about their default search button on the handset. And I was told, yes, that belongs to Google. This executive of a Japanese wireless company told me. I said, so you like Google? He shook his head. Didn't seem to like Google very much. I said, well, they're on your handset. He said, yeah. I said, they pay you for that, don't they? Yeah, they do. Not much, he said. Well, why don't you get somebody else? We have to have Google, he tells me. The customers want Google. Okay. Clearwire, trying to be the fifth wireless network in America, nationwide, using so-called 4G or WiMAX technology, is in some respects Docomo's poor stepsister here in the United States. It's conducting a very ambitious campaign. It has 3 million wireless subscribers now to provide very high-speed access to its customers by building out an entirely new network with entirely new technology. And it's a joint venture, in essence, although it is a public company and has investor funding from shareholders, in addition to Intel, Bell Canada, Motorola, Comcast, Time Warner, Google, and Bright House. And there's a lot of integration. The default search engine is Google. It has a nice little button on the handsets. The retailers who are investors in the project, they get special relationships to retail the product. And we certainly hope the Clearwire does well to bring competition, more competition, and better technology, advanced state-of-the-art wireless, to the marketplace. Clearwire blocks competing voice over internet products. Clearwire has a lot of exclusion, a lot of vertical integration, a lot of deals. Now, this sort of thing, and in fact, even tiny little wireless ISPs, if you read their accepted use policies, have all kinds of restriction on use. You have to use their modems, you can't do things that they haven't authorized in the agreement. All kinds of restrictions with what you can do with their wireless signal. And these firms have no market power whatsoever. There is no vertical foreclosure that has even a cent of anti-competitive intent or effect. And why is that important? It's important precisely because of the fact that these firms are pursuing business plans that they believe are the best way for them to provide new services to the market and to efficiently gain a toehold that will be productive in providing competition to existing providers. Now, that's something we ought to take account of, because indeed there is no categorical reason why vertical integration, even those vertical rules that have some exclusive characteristic to them, is inherently anti-consumer. The architectural view of the network that says that there is a categorical restraint of trade created by such structures is, in my opinion, a misdirection play. The argument that the internet is open end-to-end is an engineering design claim. And of course, it's hotly debated among engineers, but the discussion there is to the side for the moment. Net neutrality regulations are economic regulation. They seek to control economic activities, regulating contracts, permitting some business models but excluding others, limiting pricing offers, governing the structure of partnerships and customer service menus. The rules are based on market structure, ownership, and product packaging. This is economic activity in the marketplace, and it is not architecturally designed. So vertical foreclosure is an economic issue, and we should analyze it as such. And we have a regime to analyze it as such. It's called antitrust law. It is a far superior framework to the dysfunctionalism of the FCC. It uses consumer welfare as its maximand, not the ethereal and inherently political public interest, convenience, or necessity. Even when antitrust errs, it tends to conduct a plausible evaluation of the relevant social trade-offs. Not so at the politics at the politics-driven regulatory commission. Where are we on time? Want me to be quiet?
It's about time that I switch over.
You know, that's about as clear as an FCC order. It's about time. Is that like reasonable network management? If you want me to stop, I certainly will. Go for it.
Okay, well, we ended. Hi, everybody. My name is Tim Wu. And as I advertise, I am indeed selling a book. I have some extras for complicated reasons. But it's actually a little undignified to be hawking my own books, but whatever. thank you for having me. Thank you for coming. So many of you are in my class, and it's a pleasure to see you. And it's actually a pleasure. I've said this before, but it has really been great being back at Harvard. I was a student here, and I gotta say, it's better being a professor. they treat you nice, but the something has changed. I've been trying to figure it out what it is. Something is different, and I was walking around. I was like, "What is it? Something's not." And I was like, "Well, maybe it's the Harkness got failed. Well, you know, it's a little different, but still, something is there. There's a huge weird building behind you. That sort of freaked me out. But one, I suddenly realized at one moment, you've moved the tree." You know the tree of, you know that metal tree? You've moved the tree. I think there's more significance to that than you realize. That tree that used, that tree that's near Gropius, made of metal? Tree of world, tree of peace? It has been moved. Anyway, that's the big change. I'm convinced that's the symbolic change that's happened, because it does seem, things just seem a lot happier than they were here when I was a student. So let me talk about net neutrality regulation. Since the topic is the future, I thought I'd go into the past, and in fact into the deep past, hundreds of years before our time, and try to talk about what the net neutrality rule is in the context of a very long-standing public policy problem, if you can call medieval governments public policy problem. There's always been this challenge in most nations, even or kingdoms, challenge of public infrastructure. There's always been certain parts of the economy which other parts of the economy depend on very heavily and are often categorized for that reason as infrastructure or as public callings or something like that. Examples are ferries, ports, roads. In medieval England, barbershops, for reasons that aren't clear. Sometimes blacksmith. There's always been certain entities which have a more central role to the economy in the sense that there are many businesses that depend on them, as I've said. And the question has been, well, what do you do about those kind of businesses? You need them to be a wealthy country. For trade to happen, you need there to be ferries and roads and ports and so forth. So the oldest and most traditional solution was to say, well, just have the government build it. I guess we can call that the Roman solution. Government builds, and a lot of this infrastructure still in the United States still built by government. Roads are built by government and maintained and supervised and so forth. So one of the most classic, Great Wall of China was built by government. It wasn't done by contractors or something. You know, it's a kind of the classic king builds everything solution. Somewhere along the line in the midst of medieval England, a different model began to emerge, and this was the idea of allowing what were essentially public facilities, or would have been thought public facilities in other countries, to be built by private entities. So whether roads or ferries or so forth, sometimes pursuant to a monopoly given by the crown. The king would say, all right, you get to do this and nobody else, what we now call a guaranteed franchise monopoly. The origins of franchise monopoly. And so this was a great innovation, I'd say, Anglo-American innovation. And the idea then became, well, are these normal businesses? And the English common law idea was, well, actually they're not quite, because they're so associated with this, they have this unusual public role, these businesses. And you can intuitively see why. If you have roads which are run by a private entity, but the private entity runs them in an unreasonable way, it can have a disproportionate effect on the entire economy. This is the essential economic point. If you have a bridge, let's say, and then the guy who runs the bridge, for whatever reason, doesn't like, we'll make a little water, Domino's pizza or something, so they don't let Domino's go over the bridge, but they do let so-and-so. Or they make a deal with one, I guess it'd be a little more modern, you know, Ford Motors versus General Motors. They favor them. You could see that there'd be ripple effects for the entire economy in having parts of the public infrastructure either be discriminatory, or the other problem they were generally worried about was monopoly. You know, you give someone a crown patent to run the, what is basically for the whole thing. You know, there's one inn in town, let's say, and so anyone doing business in that town has to stay in that one inn or face being attacked by brigands on the road. Well, then they're in this strong position to charge whatever price they want, and so this was another concern. So traditionally, when it came to public infrastructure, the English common law was very sensitive to the idea there needs to be some regulation for of price, traditionally, and some regulation against discrimination. And I want to repeat the economic point why that is. The idea is that these are businesses, whether or not they're monopolies, that have a disproportionate influence on the economy, that they are inputs into everything, shall we say. You could see that, and so the effects of their decisions are amplified. This common law doctrine had two names. Either it was called the public callings doctrine, or it was called the common carriage doctrine. And you will see, and what I'm suggesting when we talk about the future of the internet, the net neutrality rules, while they seem modern and you have this exciting name, although they really are an effort to struggle with the same basic problem that that the English common law courts dealt with in the 16th century. How or what kind of duties should public infrastructure carriers possess? Now, in the United States, basically, moving forward 200 or 300 years, basically, as you know, is adopted English laws for most things, being originally Englishmen, kind of the rebel sister of the family, and basically stuck with most of the English ideas, and one of them was common carriage or public callings law. And eventually, and this was an innovation, and also an American innovation, eventually, when we started to have a communications infrastructure, the telegram, telegraph, telephone, said, well, these are kind of similar to roads and bridges and ferries and so forth. They also are relied on by businesses. They also are usually often in a monopoly situation, either a general sort of economic monopoly of more of a class, or they have a specific monopoly. You need them right now, and they're in a position to get a lot of money out of you. So starting in about 1910, earlier in the States, the Taft administration was the first to enact what you might consider a net neutrality-like law for communications, which is basically just you have to post your rates and not discriminate. That tradition continued all the way and was fortified and in fact extended and arguably and probably clearly overextended during the era of the Bell monopoly. And you had extensive regulation by the Federal Communications Commission. So there was a continuation of those sort of common law policies taking into a federal agency and much more extensive. There's a lot of problems with the overregulation of the Bell monopoly. I don't want to talk about it, and also the Bell monopoly itself. Since about the 1970s and through the 1980s, there was a movement, which I associate my co-panelists with, to say, you know, we can kind of do without this, these regulations. The common carriage regime for many of these systems is not necessary. We've overdone it. We've overregulated. The regulatory state's gone too far. And there can be reliably, we hope, competition everywhere. Competition, basically, can serve as a substitute for regulation, a substitute in many areas. And to a greater extent, we thought it considered as a substitute for regulation for public infrastructure. And this movement was not only talking about communications, but also things like the airline industry, the oil and gas, so forth. Then all these cases, we can maybe perhaps somehow introduce competition and it will solve all our problems. What I'm trying to suggest is that net neutrality has risen as a much weaker form of common carriage with only the anti-discrimination duties, as a reaction to a failure of the model that competition can solve all problems. In the late 1990s, you know, we really took a go at it. There was a strong effort to try, and it reached its height in the after the 1996 Telecom Act, which I won't go into. If you're in my class, we'll learn about it today. There was a very strong effort to try to say, let's see if we can make all these industries as competitive as possible. Is this going to work? And I think that what has happened and some of the return to a net neutrality framework comes from a sense that maybe there was some wisdom in the original common law ideas. That is to say, maybe there is, and this is what I would base the argument for the net neutrality rules on the idea that there are, in fact, in some areas, parts of the market that will tend towards monopolization. And whether they do or not, there are reasons you might want, for particular industries, duties of non-discrimination that you wouldn't care about in other industries. That is to say, when you have something that is an input to so many facets of life and business, you might be interested in that basic input, whether it is a road, whether, again, it's a bridge, whether it's a ferry, whether it's whatever it is, that input to be provided in a non-discriminatory way so it can support the broadest amount of competition on top of it, and also so it can support the broadest number of uses on top of it. So that is the underlying idea, I think, of net neutrality, is that while it may, as I said, seem modern, it's actually based on that same old-fashioned idea that the English courts intuited in the 16th century sometime. So in some ways, I'm a traditionalist in my advocacy of net neutrality. I have a sense that certain human problems do recur, are not... I don't think that the theories of the 70s and 80s, I think they had some important contributions. I don't think they solved all problems. And I think that there are parts of the economy that will always have a certain more of a public feature than other ones, and therefore should ask of them non-discriminatory duties. Let me finish. I don't want to run over my time too much either, by talking about the future. So where does this leave the future of the internet? It's a very interesting question. As I said, this is net neutrality. All of these things are an ongoing experiment. We experimented with extremely strong, over the top regulatory framework with the AT&T monopoly for 70 years, and eventually, I think we felt like, you know, this, we really let this go too far. Starting the 70s through to the early 2000s. Probably at its height in about 2006, we experimented with the opposite, with extreme deregulation. The idea that basically a television is a toaster with a screen, to quote a famous line from a Republican administration FCC chair. There's no difference. Communications is like any other industry. There's no difference between it. And I think there's what net neutrality is somewhere between those two extremes. We can disagree where it is, but further, I would say nowhere near as far as the Bell regulator, but a slight retreat from the extreme deregulatory position and a basic non-discrimination duty for what is very clearly public infrastructure. Taking us towards the future, it's interesting to speculate or wonder. I guess I'd put two questions out there. Number one, interesting question, is to ask whether the economics of natural monopoly, the economics that suggest that you only really need one wire to the house because once consumers have one wire, they're happy, will suggest a very happy future for the cable industry and an unhappy future for everyone else. That is to say, whether the tendency of consolidation, and your talk about Clearwire and some of the other competing entities, whether those guys have a chance, to put it that way, or whether the historic tendency and what we've seen over since about 1996 towards now of reduced and increasingly less competition in the last loop, in the market for internet access, will continue, and you'll end up with a sort of a one company to rule them all, or one or two industry to rule them all situation. And I could be wrong, could end up we things reverse course and we go back to a multi-competitive system. But I don't know. It's sort of a test, a live test of the economics of natural monopoly. Second question is whether, given the net neutrality rule, matters will shift. And I suspect this things are already shifting, that a lot of the interest in politics of the internet are shifting to an interest in platforms, that is, Facebook, Apple, Google, to the application, the dominant firms at the application layer. Today, if for example, Apple's being watched pretty carefully, but if they wanted to block an application because it was troublesome to them, like Skype was at one point, the voice over IP company, I think increasingly firms are not turning to their carriers, they're not necessarily turning to AT&T or Verizon to block. I think they're doing more of the work of what you were talking about, vertical foreclosure, or trying to do a little vertical leveraging, trying to create a disadvantage if they want to, through the platform, through the operating system, through app placement, through those kind of things, more than the wires or over the wireless. So the question is then whether this question of what it means to have an open market on the internet is going to shift, first of all, to the technologically to the platform, and then legally, that would give you a new agency to spend more time with, namely the FTC or the Antitrust Department and their particular powers. I have a sense the next chapter of internet scrutiny may be written at that agency. That's one of my predictions. So I don't want to use any more time. Thank you very much. And I guess we'll... Do you want to ask each other questions, or what do we do next?
Professor Hazlett can respond, or you can take audience questions.
I have a question for Hazlett, but I'll Professor Hazlett, or...
Why
don't you go first?
I'm struck as what a victim I've been today. I've been the victim of two very, very cruel incidents. And the first was 6:30 this morning when I was at Dulles Airport, and they had my... they canceled the flight I was originally on yesterday, and I was interested, but anyway, you know, see whether I can get into Boston today, and it said Boston. I was so relieved. Then I looked right next to it, and the gate next door to us, right there on the sign, it said Orlando. And I complained about it. I said, you can't do this to people. And then the other is, I'm a victim of the fact that here I'm with Tim Wu, and we've got 45 minutes to discuss net neutrality, and that's just
beyond... I can go a little further.
Beyond,
I can move my class back.
You know, yeah. Cruel and unusual. Yeah. I mean, there's so many ways to go here, and it is a fascinating discussion, and Tim knows a lot, and it's fun to probe. So have at it. So AT&T's regulation by the FCC is why we should have net neutrality. And I know you're very big on the Carter phone decision in 68, but here's just a flag. Go read the Huber Treatise. And you'll understand what happens in the 1934 Communications Act for about 4 or 5 decades, including a decade after the Carter phone decision. And that is that the FCC, the regulators are the problem. The regulators are protecting monopoly. It's supposed to be common carriage. It's not. Why? Because the regulators are off the reservation on this thing. Yeah. And you can say that they're bought and, you know, so forth and so on. Mm-hmm. But by the way, the U.S. was radical. We had a private monopolist dominating the sector. Everybody else looked at the U.S. Right. and said, geez, how could you not have a state-owned PTT? You know, we were the radical, and we were the innovators. We had Bell Labs. We did lead the world. And so the best system was a terrible system, and the reason over the last 20, it's not as much as I'd like to give credit to people like Hazlett or even our late friend and hero Alfred Kahn, who just passed away December 27th, the Dean of Regulatory Economists, who's so much a part of this. I wrote a piece on the event in the Financial Times saying that the 1996 Telecommunications Act was a pay-on to the Dean of Regulatory Economists, Alfred Kahn.
Right.
And there is this great transformation that your colleague Tom Merrill and his co-author wrote up very nicely a few years back in the Columbia Law Review. There's a great transformation of this public utility regulation and the pro-cartel regulation that came through from 1887 through the New Deal, through many decades of this development that you're talking about,
right.
Extremely anti-consumer. It breaks down because it's hurting the economy.
Right.
And a wide coalition, including, of course, Senator Kennedy with Alfred Kahn and Stephen Breyer and so forth, start things off in the airline industry, and it does go into many other sectors. And we still have regulation. Part of that great transformation is that some of these competitive industries like airlines are just deregulated in terms of fare setting and entry and exit. But there is still a kernel of essential facility problem in some industries, some distribution industries, and there's still some residual regulation, and that's under antitrust rules. And yes, we've developed this for hundreds of years. I love your pitch for common law, but
right.
That's the antithesis of the agency-driven regulation. That's the alternative. Alfred Kahn's paper on net neutrality. Use antitrust. Don't use this categorical exclusion of activity that is largely pro-competitive and pro-consumer and certainly pro-innovation. So it seems to me very, you know, it just seems like a non sequitur. And I knew that there was the obvious non sequitur in net neutrality regulation is the internet is great. It's open. It's pro-innovation. Let's regulate it. Okay, we got these models because of the flux in the marketplace. And by the way, there's a lot of non-neutral stuff, as I mentioned, but if you want to call it open, fine. I'll pat you on the back for it. It's pro-competitive. It's a wonderful, evolving network of networks. Why screw it up? Well, the idea is, well, we're going to freeze these models and these structures and these this level of vertical integration into place. And the FCC has no idea what it's talking about. You look at the Comcast ruling and how it gets reamed out on the law, but you look at the economics of that case, and you'll be even more appalled. You look at the net neutrality report and order that they put in your Christmas stocking on the December 23rd, and you'll find that the economics are the empirical. Sure, they have stories about blocking, but universities block. University has no anti-competitive incentive to block content. It's just a network management issue. They cherry-pick the stories, they cherry-pick the theory, and they don't have any empirical validity whatever. They have one footnote to one paper, which they flat out misinterpreted. Okay, it's a footnote 60, Goolsbee, 2007. The paper says the opposite of what they say it says. Okay, so that's your regulatory institution. Go back to AT&T. AT&T is protecting monopoly, fending off all the entrants into the marketplace. And how do we get rid of that? An antitrust action. So we went back to common law, okay? Right. And then legislation in the Telecommunications Act. And the FCC did its level best to screw that up. And after several years, the DC Circuit said, thank you, but no thank you. Go away. You didn't get the preamble, let alone the substance of the 1996 Telecommunications Act, right? And the thing collapsed. And what do we have now? We have head-to-head competition and telephony. Okay, so all this talk about monopoly and essential facilities, yeah, it's still there under antitrust, but guess what? We've got something far, far better, head-to-head competition. And it's very innovative. It gives us the new technologies that really exploit the future opportunities. And I don't know why there's a desire to go back when we can go forward and get rid of all the stuff that didn't work.
Right. All right, well, let me respond to that. See, I have a... Your view is if I'm going to take it, I'm going to caricature a little bit, say, FCC bad, antitrust law good. You're not saying completely that regulation is always bad, but you are saying that regulation comes from the FCC is necessarily bad, and regulation that comes from common law courts or from the antitrust department through courts is good. I guess I don't see it that way. I think the FCC has, I will agree profoundly and strongly, has in its history been a force for suppression of innovation and protection of monopoly. There's no question, and I can't disagree with that. I've been teaching telecom class, I'm reminded every year, it suppressed the cable industry, suppressed competition in the phone networks for years. But the FCC has also had its moments. And if you want to talk about what got the internet started, it's not a full picture to just say it's the AT&T breakup. You have to point to things like Carter Phone, which for people who don't know is the right to attach something to the phone network, to measures that allowed companies like AOL or CompuServe even to get started, I mean Computer 2 for people who know about it, to measures that allowed long-distance competition. All of these reference FCC rules. So the FCC is a two-headed creature. It can be a creature that opens markets, protects entrants from being destroyed on arrival, or it can be an agent of the monopolist. I don't take the view that what you are sort of taking, that everything it does is immediately stained. The other thing I'll suggest is I do agree, and I think there is this real tension for anyone playing in this field, and a real nervousness about the fact that any regulation, for me at least, that any regulation, or that regulations do, even if they're well-intended, occasionally become the tool of monopoly. I can't deny that. On the other hand, I think we're also not happy and cannot put up with a world of absolutely no public oversight of these industries. They're too important, and I want to raise a reason for that, which is different than any of the economic literature you're talking about, which is that these are also speech industries. That these are ultimately industries that have a disproportionate influence, not just on the price of your phone bill, but also on speech industries. Less true when it was the phone, just when we were talking about AT&T, but when you're talking about the internet, you're now talking about an industry that carries all speech. And so there is a another aspect of this, and a history which precedes common carriage regulation of powerful communications monopolies using the power to try to move and to try to kick over elections, to spy on people. There's a lot of danger of a total lack of federal oversight on the nation's most powerful communications companies because they are ultimately in a very sensitive position. And what we're looking for with net neutrality and a very diminished FCC, as I see it, is this idea that there is someone looking out. I mean, even Michael Powell took this role, who was a very deregulationist guy, to say there's got to be someone, and I feel this, the financial crisis has given this sense to some piece of oversight looking to see that the worst kinds of private abuse does not happen. Because it's certain, the temptation is obvious and clear, and it needs to be overseen. But you're right, we're walking a thin line. It's a challenge, and that's why I'm against these sort of easy answers, which are to say antitrust has all the answers and FCC never has the answers. I think it depends how you manage things. So, shall we take questions?
Let me just say, with all due respect, I mean, that's a straw man. Obviously, the FCC gets some things right. I'm happy to send you a very nice piece I wrote last summer congratulating the FCC on focusing on spectrum allocation and getting away from this poetry about unlicensed spectrum as a substitute for licensed spectrum and development of competitive mobile networks. And that happened under Obama, and it was a rejection, a flat-out rejection of the Powell FCC that for years had really wasted time and stunted development of networks. And the FCC, I spent a little time there, and it's... some of my best friends are FCC bureaucrats. So they're earnest. I mean, that's the scary part. I'm in awe of some of my longtime friends that just show up every day and they do the same thing and they get slammed, and then they go home at night and go to sleep and get up and do the next. They operate in good faith the next day. And it's a different world, but the courts are certainly not perfect. But when you say that the FCC is going to remedy a lot of these things, I think you better be very specific and very sure it's going to improve the world. It's all a matter of relative to something else, can we do better? And relative to the FCC making categorical judgments that even firms without market power can engage in exclusive deals. The cable operators now, they have a very discriminatory use of their cable data networks called digital phone service, where they provide five nines quality, so to speak, carrier quality telephone, voice telephone service, and it's absolutely pro-competitive. Vonage can't get it. Skype can't use that great dedicated bandwidth on the digital two-way part of their cable networks. It goes to the Time Warner's digital phone service or Comcast or Cox, whoever the cable company is, and they use that for their customers. And what has it done? It's brought us head-to-head telephone service, the stuff that the FCC for many years has said that they were trying to promote. They finally backed away from the unbundling and network sharing stuff.
It was Congress's idea, not the FCC's. Anyway, sorry.
What's that?
The 96 Act.
No. The 96 Act was thrown to the FCC that screwed it up for 8 years. I'm talking about what happened in 2004 when the D.C. Circuit threw it out. In the last 6-7 years, you've gotten 100 million homes built out for head-to-head phone competition. I'm talking about fixed. I know these are law students. You know what fixed... Have you told them what fixed phone service is? Fixed line phone service?
Yes.
Yeah, nobody, I know.
Right.
But anyway, that 23 million subscribers now, 100 million homes passed for that. That's a competitive service challenging the incumbent telcos. And it got there because, in large measure, of this discriminatory use of the cable network by the cable operators to have a premium phone voice product. And
would you agree that there's nothing to do with net neutrality? Has always been that's private networks are fine. You want to set up a private phone network?
Absolutely not. That can be challenged under the general net neutrality rule. You have no idea how that's going to come out. I hope they challenge it because you're going to get a little work out of it. I'm going to get a little work out of it. We're going to be the only people to benefit in the long run. and so what's not to like? But the fact is that. Absolutely can be challenged. These kinds of things have already been challenged. Leased access and all these kinds of access rules for the cable operators constantly being used as levers to try to come into the market. And either it's a waste of time and it just churns up some rent-seeking cost for society, or it really does deter investment. And when you invite me back for the next talk, I'll be happy to go through some of the research that's been done there that I've been involved with, that the FCC is completely ignoring on the anti-incentive, the incentive effects for anti-investment incentives that come with these network government oversight rules. But the antitrust regime is there. And I think, objectively looking at it, it's very hard to say that given your argument about common law doing so well over time to develop essential facilities rules of access and non-discrimination, that we should throw that out and go the other direction. Right. With these categorical regulatory edicts that come from this politicized agency.
Yeah, I mean, it's a little bit of a shell game, and I won't put it... I won't equate you in the industry. I mean, the industry will always say that everything should be antitrust, and then when it comes to antitrust, they're like, the antitrust laws are too aggressive, they should never be enforced at all. And I think you may have a different position, but the industry's position is always to say, move everything to antitrust, and then when it comes to antitrust, like, no, the antitrust laws have gone too far.
Yeah.
You know, it ends up at zero.
So what's your,
it's a bit of a shell. I'm saying that it's...
I actually don't want to say to you.
I think the industry's position on antitrust versus FCC is not a position of any integrity. It's a position of we never ever want to be regulated.
Are you saying that the corporations are self-interested, and they put proposals out for policy that help their shareholders? I am shocked.
The antitrust laws I'm not going to deny over the long term have had an effect. They, in their current state after Trinco. And in the current configuration of antitrust, it's not, they barely exist, let's put it that way. So to say we should have antitrust law covering this is to say we shouldn't have any law at all. It's just the extreme position of having no law at all.
Why don't we think about that in terms of net neutrality? Isn't that going to make it worse to get people into court? Because that's the Trinco rule. The Trinco rule is if you're going to get it hit one time, there's no double jeopardy.
The other position is that there are different interests here than antitrust is interested in. Antitrust law is obsessed with pricing. And obsessed with trying to define market monopolies. And I'm suggesting there are interests beyond pure economic interests in these markets at stake here. That's number one. And number two, and you definitely can't disagree with this, the pace of antitrust litigation, if it once was different in the 19th century or in the early 20th century, is now so slow that you can't even dream of having a problem. Let's say Skype was trying to get started, voice over IP company, and immediately blocked by every broadband provider. Well, okay, file antitrust. You know, their estate will be filing the antitrust claim and collecting on it. You know, you'll be dead in a year, and the antitrust case will take 15 years. So, I mean, it's a joke to say that antitrust can deal with a problem that requires immediate remedies against anti-competitive behavior. And you know for a fact that companies do what is in their interest. The fact that companies will use their local monopolies to the extent possible is why you need anti-discrimination rules for exactly the reason you said. No voice over IP company, I say to you that Skype, Vonage, these companies would be in their graveyards right now if it hadn't been for even the slightest minimal amount of FCC oversight under Michael Powell. And with the positions you advocate, we would be in a market that would simply, you know, be very good for cable and phone companies, and in some ways might slowly lead them back to their monopoly. You might have a sort of duopoly, but would be terrible for consumers and will have destroyed a lot of innovation. And it sounds good in principle, but it's bad for us. So anyway, maybe we should take questions, or if you want to.
I think questions is a good idea.
I have a question for Professor Haslett. We're talking a lot about this is the marketplace, and you threw up the term network of networks. And there are thousands of networks that comprise the internet. One of the things I've been interested in, but haven't seen a lot written about, is how consumers might be able to express their preferences with regards to whether they prefer a neutral network or a non-neutral network, considering that even if they're signed up, you know, if I'm trying to get to you, I signed up with a neutral ISP, and you're signed up with a neutral ISP, the dozen ISPs I might get to in between could do any number of things, because there's not any sort of direct passageways negotiated, and how consumers might be able to pass some price signals given the technical architecture of the internet.
Well, yeah, I mean,
we've had that choice, and in fact, you know, some of my empirical work here that I know you're upset that we didn't get to the PowerPoints. show that we have run this test. It's just fascinating that the federal regulatory agency is just not interested in the fact that we have had open access rules on broadband ISPs. We've had other competing ISPs that had no broadband access rules. In your terminology or in legal terminology, they were closed networks. In fact, they had their own proprietary ISPs, Excite at Home being an obvious example on the cable side, unregulated. There was all sorts of effort to open them up with open access rules 10 years ago. They all failed. The FCC strenuously objected to any regulation of open access under the Clinton FCC, saying we don't have a monopoly, we don't have a duopoly, we have a noopoly. The idea being, yes, this will diminish investment in the network. We want to build out the network and then look and see how much competition we have. But the fact is, when customers had a chance to choose between the open, regulated network, DSL, and the closed proprietary network, cable modem service, they preferred the closed network. It built out more aggressively and offered better quality service according to subscribership, when in fact, the FCC, starting in 2003, eliminated the network sharing rules for DSL. Guess what happens to DSL? Subscribership takes off relative to cable modem service. Okay? Now that also is adjusted for general technology and cost changes in the market because we're able to use Canada as a proxy for some of these overall market changes. A very strong evidence that in fact the incentives, particularly on the supply side of course, for the phone companies were to invest much more aggressively and to have better networks the customers preferred more when the open access requirements were eliminated. Now that's economic evidence, and maybe Tim's upset that the antitrust court spent a lot of time on it, but they should spend a lot of time on that, in my opinion, because we're talking about how much welfare is produced by a legal regime for the ultimate beneficiaries, the consumers. And the open access rules, which are the predecessor, so to speak, to the net neutrality regime of now, was not satisfactory. It was anti-consumer in its effect.
I haven't heard you, you know, everything that you say, and I guess I'm trying to make it more exciting, is about how life should be better for cable or phone companies, which is great, but I mean, isn't there some other people who matter here? Consumers, Facebook, applications. You know, there's more to this economy than just the maximum profit for cable and phone companies. I mean, I agree when they have more money, they have more reasons to invest, but that's not the only calculus in town here.
Well,
I'm
almost glad, Tim, that you accuse me of this, because it makes me think that people are reading and thinking about today, and though I'm still part of the world, because if you were familiar with my stuff, and I wrote a lot of stuff on cable in the 80s and 90s, and I hope you teach preferred communications versus the City of Los Angeles to your students. A wonderful case in which the 86 Supreme Court case where I was the expert witness for the plaintiff. I spent way too much of my life on the issue of competition at the local level. And believe me, I was persona non grata in the cable industry. And I got the nasty little jabs from the industry to prove it. But there's a lot of anti-competitive stuff that's taken place. And the franchising stuff has been terrible. And there's still some work to do, but that's gotten a lot better. There's a lot more competition, particularly in the cable market, with satellite, telco TV, and over-the-top broadband. So, I'm totally in favor of progress. Right. And it's progress when you get more competition in these markets. But that's where we ought to focus. And that's where people who really are interested in consumer welfare ought to be looking. Categorical rules against vertical integration are very deleterious to investment, to innovation and business models, and sometimes the businesses say that exactly, and other times they say the opposite. But just because Google's saying the opposite doesn't mean it's wrong.
Right.
Doesn't mean it's right or wrong. I mean it's and the fact that Comcast is on one side or the other is totally irrelevant. Right. So
maybe we really haven't given student any more questions. Maybe we should take one more question and then I think I've got class or something starting. Why don't we take a breath?
So it seems to me that Professor Wu's sort of argument talks a lot about innovation at the app level and the higher sort of post-platform innovation on the internet. And Professor Hazlett, you're talking more about innovation that would occur to improve the network itself and the infrastructure at the ground. And so my question is, sort of under the non-net neutrality or pro-net neutrality argument. How do, Professor Hazlett, how do you see that, your world encouraging innovation on the app level? And Professor Wu, how do you see your world encouraging innovation on the network level? Or alternatively, why would you think that innovation in one of those two worlds is sort of in a diminishing return situation?
I'm so glad you asked that question in exactly that way, because that is absolutely the wrong way to think about it. Okay? You better take Professor Wu. I'm going to give you an F. If that shows up on an answer, I'm going to give you an F for it. Okay? And it'll be in a long line of Fs. Okay?
Fortunately, he's my student, so.
Yeah, exactly. So you're okay with that. You're okay. But I have heard colleagues, in this debate say, well, look at the apps. They're getting all this innovation in the core. What has it got? Okay, it's not. The whole argument for net neutrality is that the core and the edge are of course they're complements. Okay, listen to my words. I talk about the complementary relationships that are absolutely essential to the development of these markets. You can't say, oh, the edge is going well, but the core is not any innovation. If the edge is doing well, then that means the core is doing something, and vice versa. People aren't going to subscribe and invest billions in transport facilities if there's no content. So it's wrong to truncate it and to look at it in that perspective. Oh, who's more? So look at Cisco. They're an interesting corporate interest because they could go either way on net neutrality. They're very much opposed to it. They want the core to do well. They like to sell routers to carriers and to internet broadband providers. But they absolutely need the edge to be dynamic and generating demand for new applications and more traffic and revenues for the ISPs. They want the whole world to expand. And that's the way I think about it. And so if you accuse me of being in the right pocket of Cisco, I'd like to be in the pocket of Cisco. But but anyway, so you see the point is that you want to think about the efficiency of the system. And you can't just pull out parts of it and say, this is what we're going to protect, and this is what we're going to hurt. And unfortunately, I think that's exactly where network neutrality goes. It takes some corporate interest and say, well, you know, you like this business structure. Let's freeze it because it seems to work for you. And these other guys don't like it, the carriers. And, that's not going to promote efficiency overall at the edge or in the core.
All right. Well, I guess I think we've overstay, unless, I mean, if people want to keep talking, that's fine, but I think we're...
Do you have a class, or...?
Yeah, I do.
Oh, is it here?
This is the most of them are here, so it's kind of replicating the class. probably an improvement on it. And first of all, I want to make one point about the edge. When I talk about the edge, I'm not only limited, and this goes back to my point about this being a speech market. My interest in the edge being vibrant is not just, oh, I want Google or Facebook. I mean, it is this interest in citizen, in basically it being a subsidy to citizen speech and to low cost and amateur speech. So I don't think Wikipedia could have survived very long without net neutrality rules or any of the blog or the blogosphere be launched without their chance, you know, to in some ways take advantage of the fact that there were limits on the discriminatory powers of the underlying network. If you imagine someone in 2002 saying, okay, I launch a blog. And if we'd had a sort of an old school or a completely deregulated or an AT&T dominated internet, it would have been, okay, well, what kind of revenue are you going to make? Let's see the business plan for your blog. Let's see some money before you get started. You know, like the way the cable network is. You want to start a cable channel or any traditional network has been, pay us so you can get started. Now, of course, a blogger needs a connection to the internet to get started, which is... one thing, but it isn't the same. A discriminatory network is very hard on amateur or non-high-income speech, and I think that's one of the advantages of what I'm talking about the edge. The second point, this is the time I'm going to agree. My argument is that innovation promoted by net neutrality rules does end up driving more revenue for the core and ends up giving the core greater reasons to want to innovate. The core is about, as you've said, moving huge amounts of data around, and that's where they make their money, and that's what they specialize, the core of the network. Well, what are those huge amounts of data? What drives that kind of data? Well, it's obviously going to be developments of better applications at the edge, things like YouTube, which consumes huge amount of bandwidth, or people have to want to use the network. And no one wants to use the core directly. unless you're a supreme geek. People want to use apps. I mean, the internet, the thing that is the truth of it is that people want apps, and apps are what are drive traffic, and ultimately what makes people want to pay for, say, Fios services that are 20 megs or something, because they actually want to use it for something. This was one of the problems that Bell had in the height of its monopoly. It was great at thinking of amazing ways of setting up a network, but terrible at thinking of new services. Their big idea for so many years was, well, we're going to have video phones or something, and that was like a 100-year project to get there and call forwarding. You know, they never understood the app side. So I agree with you that they work in tandem, and that's what drives demand and innovation at the core, is innovation usually at the app side.
Yeah, I don't understand what the argument is that Wikipedia would have been crushed if not for net neutrality. We don't have net neutrality. And Wikipedia is doing just fine, apparently. We're going to have new rules in the future. But think about this if you want to talk about the apps and the core. You read the David Weiss biography of Google, which I think is a wonderful book, and he says the number one, the biggest thing that happened in the entire commercial history of Google was, I think it was May 1, 2002, when 34 million AOL subscribers fired up their startup page, and they saw a new default search engine, Google. And Google bet the company on that. They paid for that. Here's a startup before the IPO, startup edge application, you know, the iconic Silicon Valley garage startup, paying the world's largest ISP, in fact, an ISP AOL Time Warner that had market power, according to the Federal Trade Commission, and they're paying them to replace the Yahoo search engine, Yahoo or Inc. to me, or they were the same. Anyway, to get preferential access to customers by paying off the ISP. Now, that's a violation of neutrality. I don't know if it violates the current FCC rule, but nobody else does either because nobody understands what the FCC rule is. Okay? But it's great. What's not to like? What's not to like about the fact that Google pays browsers and ISPs all over the world to get preferential access? The mobile operator in Japan and everywhere else. What's wrong with those deals? They're exclusive, they're discriminatory. Today they block new startups. Why? Because Google's everywhere. But that's the market, and the market is extremely innovative in terms of coming up with new business models that work. It is not a threat to have these vertical contracts. In fact, it's a feature. So I think that the argument that these companies, these startups, would have died, well, we didn't have net neutrality, and they did just fine.
It depends what you mean by net neutrality. We had an internet built on a layered structure that had, in some sense, using Larry Lessig terminology, protected the basic neutrality network through code as opposed to law. We did have federal oversight. You know, when people violated, in fact, we did have net neutrality. I'll just say that.
I guess we disagree on this assessment.
Paying the ISP for these slots?
Okay, well, what happened when Madison River blocked a voice over IP service? The FCC stepped in and fined them. What happened when Comcast started blocking BitTorrent? The FCC, reversed by the DC Circuit, came in and so we've had a system of federal oversight, and also we've had the underlying internet being neutral. And the idea of net neutrality is to defend that underlying layered nature of the network. So I know we could.
We seem to be unable to reach student questions, but it's amazing actually to me that telecom has become an area where you know, once kind of probably a sleepy backwater where you have a talk and people get quite passionate. Should we stop? I'll ask the organizers.
We have your class.
So. You guys want to go 5? Let's start at a nice 1:30. People can leave if they need to, but why don't we go to 1:30 since we don't have Professor Hazlett here this often. Looks like we have, I think you were waiting, and then take the, yeah.
Forgive me, first of all, I'm not a lawyer. I'm a researcher at MIT Media Lab. And so,
at where? What did you say?
MIT.
Media Lab, yeah.
Yeah. And we submitted that to the internet. But right. My question is this. One of my favorite services in the world is Netflix, and particularly the streaming aspect of Netflix, yeah. Which at times consumes 20% of the bandwidth.
Right.
And the thing that's interesting to me about net neutrality is, I would
say the vast majority of people in this room get their internet at their house. The last mile is provided by a cable provider or a telco.
Yeah.
And both of those telcos and cable providers have their own video on demand services now.
Right.
It's very much in their best interest in order to not allow you to purchase Netflix streaming service, and instead be forced to use their own proprietary video streaming services, which the market thus far has shown are not as successful as Netflix. And I think that if you would do some work, you would find that if they did do that, people would not just abandon the services because of the sort of monopoly that those providers hold. There's no real alternative for me to get Netflix streaming if I don't have Comcast or AT&T or something.
Well, you can't list multiple alternatives and say there's no alternative.
Well, I think that both of them have their commercial interest. So
of course they have their commercial interest. If the FCC, and that was the Comcast case, by the way, in 2008, and where was the evidence that they were using network management to block competition of their pay-per-view service? It got two sentences in the FCC order. It had no analysis. It had no facts. And it's wholly implausible. The reason they didn't create an analysis, an economic analysis. I mean, this is one of the great advantages of an antitrust court, is you get smart lawyers on both sides, and there is a burden of proof. And you actually have to come up with facts and evidence and a theory of the case. And the FCC, they didn't get to the theory of the case in the court because the FCC had no jurisdiction, and the thing stopped there. But if the fascinating part of that order to me is that the FCC has to have a reason why network management is in the purview of the, I mean, what are they going to do? Look at a cable operator and say, we don't like the way you're managing your network. What's the jurisdiction? Well, the jurisdiction is what you say. Well, they're doing things anti-competitive. They're blocking. But degrading their broadband, off which they might make about $7 billion a year, I think is the Comcast number from 2008, to protect a $300 million a year pay-per-view service, doesn't make a lot of sense right off the top. And if there really is an argument there, okay, they should say it. Now, right now, Netflix is doing fine. Maybe you understand and can teach your students why Netflix is such a hot stock right now. I have no idea what the proprietary business model is that makes them so valuable. They just knock Blockbuster out, and they're just going gangbusters. And like you say, this huge amount of traffic is coming. But why should that traffic get onto these networks without paying the local network? So that seems right. So you should set the business model.
Well, hold on. Let me finish. Right. And so as the subscriber, I have paid Comcast to provide me bits from the internet. And therefore, I have requested those bits be provided me from Netflix.
Okay.
I don't think Netflix would have to pay Comcast in order to get...
So I've also paid Comcast.
So basically...
Well, that's your opinion. And I've also paid Comcast, and I'm not a Netflix person. And all of a sudden... A large percentage of the traffic on that network, and in fact, Comcast said, we're going to have to, double the build out here. It's going to be very expensive. We're going to raise our rates now just a little bit here, get this higher speed. That's good. You like that? Now, why is that a better model? In fact, David Clark, okay, he's end-to-end. He's the author, the co-author of the end-to-end paper. He thinks it's great. He wrote a very nice 2007 paper. He thinks there really ought to be a flow of money from what he calls the large content networks like Netflix to the large eyeball networks like Comcast.
Okay, you're confused.
Let me just finish
that.
Right. So you want a price signal. If this service, which is great, and I actually just did drop my premium service to go all Netflix on my movies, so it's very nice. I like Netflix. But if you're going to say there shouldn't be a price signal that says people love Netflix and they want all this capacity, you're going to have a flat-out inefficiency in the network where a lot of the benefit is going to be shifted onto third parties, and it's going to break down.
Can I present the issue a little more starkly? Without some kind of presumptive net neutrality rule, there would have been no Netflix, let's just face it. And right now, if the cable industry could wave a magic wand and destroy Netflix without any federal oversight, of course they would. You said it before, they're profit-maximizing entities. They want, and that, there's nothing wrong with that desire, it's natural. But why the hell do you want a competitor running over your lines, eating into your video over demand business? It's craziness. If I were a cable company, I would be leading the campaign, if I wasn't trying to buy NBC, of trying to destroy Netflix. Why not? When I worked in industry, that's what we did. We spent half the time trying to figure out how to kill our competitors. Why not? Are we not businessmen here? But that
because it's like, costly. I mean, if they could, you know, they would. But by the way, I know you give the common
not?
Carrier Netflix. You know,
are you trying to say businesses don't do what's in their interest?
So Netflix, is your argument that Netflix has used the common carrier model of the post office? Because
they have that.
So but the thing that strikes me about that is there are levels of service from the post office, and you can get overnight express, and you can get stuff that's a high quality delivery service, and they price for it. And so that's where we're, in fact, these net neutrality rules, yes, that pushes a lot more tiering, a lot more pricing. A lot of this stuff will come out in the wash. I don't think it's going to be the end of the world with these very kind of fuzzy net neutrality rules going in.
Don't you think that cable companies, why would, if you were working for Comcast, why wouldn't you want to destroy Netflix? If you could just block them. Which you can. I mean, it's not that difficult. China blocks things.
Look,
you know, it's easy. Why don't you just block Netflix?
It's ridiculous. Netflix is a complement as well as a substitute. It's a complement to your broadband service. The more of your customers are using Netflix, the more they want your high capacity, high speed network. So that actually works out pretty nicely. There's some footnotes, but that works out pretty nicely. You like Netflix. This is the problem. They get $7 billion a year, plus or minus. I don't have the exact numbers. From cable modem service. They get a very much smaller, about 1/20th that, from pay-per-view, which is the direct competitor to this video streaming product. Okay? It's absolutely silly to say that Comcast is out there trying to figure out ways to destroy Netflix.
I'm saying Netflix never gets started.
Netflix got started in the mail, and now they're
right.
doing streaming.
On another neutral network.
And they can only survive. There's no neutrality.
They got started on the post office network because that was the other neutral.
And now they're streaming. They're 20% of the market,
right,
in terms of traffic.
Right.
And there's no net neutrality rule that defends that. And the cable operators, in fact, the entire cable model is in the process of perhaps switching to just a capacity model. But they can price that. If they're a great network, they can raise their prices for that and lower the price for the video.
I think we better end for those two. All right. Well, thanks.